Welcome to Profit Boss Radio. I'm your host, Hillary Hendershot, and this is episode 83. Profit Boss Radio is your weekly wealth mastermind. Profit Boss is also a community and a movement for women who are ready to take control of their money, break the glass ceiling, and give ourselves permission to finally have enough. Want the secrets of wealth to be yours? This is the place. I'm Hillary Hendershot. I'm a certified financial planner running a leading advisory firm for women, and I'm sharing with you real stories from real life and real women who are making it happen. Forget Wall Street. Let's do this, ladies. People with a written financial plan are 60% more likely to increase their savings over time and twice as likely to stick to their savings plan than those who don't accomplish the simple step of just writing it down. Yet just 24% of Americans say they have a wealth plan in writing. I want us to change those statistics, and I've got an offer for you that's going to make it as easy as 1, 2, 3 for you to get your wealth plan in order. The first step to having a wealth plan is taking stock of what's already there. You have to know your net worth. You have to know where you're starting from in order to get to your destination. And knowing what your financial life looks like at a glance is the key. You can use a financial dashboard to manage your wealth plan, and I am giving you free access to the same financial dashboard I use with my most successful clients. A financial dashboard allows you to track your bank accounts, categorize your spending, track real estate and mortgages, including even knowing the difference between principal and interest, and your investments and your credit cards, and see it all at one place and at your fingertips. I think we can all agree that having one location, both on the web and on your mobile device, to view your entire financial picture saves you time and frustration. It also empowers you to take control. This is an exclusive offer for the Profit Boss audience. To take advantage, just go to hillaryhendershot.com/eMoney. This is the same technology I make available to my comprehensive financial planning clients. It has superior security with 256-bit secure socket layer encryption. They literally have a team of security experts trying to hack the system at all times, but no one has ever succeeded, and it's a VeriSign secure site. The portal itself is totally non-transactional, so no one can move, withdraw, or access your money. It just puts all the same data that's already online in one place so you can see it. You input your various passwords, and those are kept private and only ever accessible to you, sort of like mint.com, but with a lot more planning power. Full disclosure, I am the advisor behind the scenes. My team and I could potentially run across your account balances. But listen, those are visible to the folks at mint.com or Personal Capital or any other financial dashboard app you might be using. And I'm here because I truly want you to be successful, and I'm not going to do wrong by you. You can trust me and my team to safeguard your information. Having a wealth plan in place is one of the 7 key steps to wealth, and the eMoney Financial Dashboard is a powerful tool that makes that possible. Once you're logged in, interactive workshop tools can help you see how changes in savings and investments today affect your future retirement goals, and that really puts you in the driver's seat. I'm proud to offer you this tool, and I hope you take advantage of it now. To request access, please go to hillaryhendershot.com/eMoney. Welcome, Profit Boss, to this episode of Profit Boss Radio. I'm here with Rachel, welcoming you to the first episode of Profit Boss Radio in November. So if you're listening to this episode as it airs, it's November 7th, 2017. The holidays are among us. It's just a few weeks to Thanksgiving if you celebrate that. And then we have Hanukkah and Christmas coming up in December. And I already see today in the car, my husband and I were talking about what to do for New Year's Eve. And I already see people complaining that the holiday displays and Christmas items are up in the stores. I don't really understand that. I never complain about that. I kind of like it. But Rachel, I know you've been doing some research on what we can expect from Profit Bosses financially during this season. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you think people ought to know about their money this holiday season?
Sure. And I'm actually hoping that our profit bosses aren't going to get into some of these situations spending wise. But the average consumer actually is expected to spend roughly $967 this holiday season. And outstanding credit card debt is expected to reach $1 trillion by New Year's. So a lot of people are going to be spending a lot of money, and it looks like a lot of it's going to be on plastic and not money that they already have.
Oh, and that's
yes.
That's,
so our profit bosses won't be doing that, but that's what's expected to happen with most consumers.
And that's what leads to the holiday debt hangover, right? Or the spending hangover. Mm-hmm. So you, with best intentions, take that plastic to the mall or to Amazon. You buy gifts you can't afford for people you truly love, meaning well, but really doing, not doing right to yourself, by yourself. So that's the profit boss promise, right? For the holiday season, don't spend what you don't got.
That's right. And don't be enticed by all the major retailers offering their 0% financing with deferred interest and all those other things that they've got going on. If it's not cold hard cash you've got in the bank, you don't want to use it.
Exactly. So now I look at credit card offers differently. For many years, many of you know that I wouldn't touch a credit card because I got myself into so much trouble. But I remember the time when in my life when I had $20,000 or $27,000 of credit card debt, and I was sort of desperately searching for that 0% transfer offer. I was doing that juggle of, can I move $5,000 to this card over here that's a 0% interest rate for, you know, 90 days or 120 days. And now, obviously, when I spend on credit, I pay it off at the end of the month, and I don't need balance transfer offers, but I still have a little bit of PTSD when I see that on the credit card offer. No, it always comes on the postcard, right? And they tell you what their balance transfer rate is. And I think, oh gosh, I don't miss those days.
I think we actually talked about on a recent episode too, where when Robert, your husband, was using credit cards for everything, it kind of freaked you out, and you were, you know, sort of had to have a compromise or talk about, you know, your different operating systems with money and with credit cards and stuff like that, because that's sort of his way of using using a credit card is to maximize like the benefits and the rewards and then pay it all off. Yeah.
And we met in the middle a little bit. So I got him to cancel two or three cards, but I think he's still got seven or eight of them. And then, you know, after we moved in April, I had to go change the mailing address on all of them. So because he doesn't do it. So all these credit card bills were coming with the old address. And I said, you've got to get this updated. And finally, I just did it.
Yeah.
So really what we're bringing to you today in today's episode, I really want to kind of get you financially prepared. So it needs to be on your mind that holiday spending is coming up. Hopefully you were listening to Profit Boss Radio last December and you set up a savings account for holiday gifts. I really like to have a drama-free holiday. So I do an auto transfer to a savings account all year, and that now it's time to spend it and the money's already there. So if you've just picked up Profit Boss Radio and you aren't prepared for this year, you can definitely be prepared for next year and every year thereafter if you set up a special savings account for holiday gifts, if that's an expense in your life. Do we have an Ask Hillary question today?
We do actually. We have a question from Jody from our Facebook group, and she is wanting to know how to get on goal with your spouse financially or get your spouse engaged in action forward thinking and reviewing today and how today affects the future. She says that she talks big picture plans and goals and they're on the same page, but her spouse actually doesn't always invest the time or interest in the minutiae of their financial life. He just really wants her to handle it all. So how do you kind of get on the same page, but also in action together?
Sure. So let me answer this question in a couple ways. I'll do a couple segments of answer. So first, let me fast forward you to a moment that might be in your future, because I've got lots of clients, married couples that look like this. So for example, the wife has done a great job of saving and investing, and the husband really just doesn't pay attention to it. And I think that there is some frustration on the part of the wife. So I literally know this situation inside and out. It's not my situation, but I know it intimately. I think that in the beginning, the wife in this case went through a period of time of dissatisfaction, wishing he would do more, wishing he would save more, wishing he appreciated her efforts more, and finally just came to a place where she accepted that he just isn't in that place mentally. He's not there. You know, if you look at the book, The Seven Stages of Money Maturity, he's, you know, a few stages below her. And she realized that she could really make a big difference for him. In fact, one time, and she meant this in all fun and love and jest, but she said, she looked at him in front of me, she looked at him and said, "You would be completely broke without me, so you better just get on board." And I'll tell you, over the period of time I've been working with them as a couple, he has expressed to her his gratitude at her effort. So it took years of building up a nest egg, and now they have a significant nest egg, and he does realize he would have nothing if it weren't for her. So I just put that out there is maybe a beacon of hope for you, Jody. Another thing is, I don't think it's that bad for you to get the opportunity to quote unquote handle it all, because it doesn't sound like he's arguing with you. I think the worst case scenario is, for example, someone wants to DIY and another person, the other partner, wants to delegate, or for example, someone wants to invest the way his father did and the wife wants to follow best practices, or, you know, if you're arguing about what to spend on and like that. I think that you could take on gently sort of managing the household finances. I think one thing that I would do is I would create a spending account for him. So I would make savings goals. So let's say income is 10 and taxes are 3 and savings is 2. And now you've got 5 left. So you say, I put 2, and you realize I'm just making these numbers up, obviously. I put 2 in a spending account for you. And this is your debit card. And that's what you get to spend. So have a great time, spend on whatever you want. And thanks for earning the money. And
that sounds like my parents.
Do your parents do that with each other or with you?
My mom does that to my dad. He has a special card, and he gets a certain amount of cash to use for his garage sailing every weekend, because she was finding he was going to the ATM and taking out cash. And then it was like, well, where did you spend this money? Because my mom's a little bit of a control freak. But I mean, in her defense, she has made it work to where they have a really great retirement and they're loving life.
Right. Right. So, I mean, I don't know that I think, I think that someone can lead financially and it's okay. I think obviously the ideal situation for someone who's very inspired to create financial freedom is that your partner would be just as inspired as you, but you can also take on being a leader. And I think that can work just fine. And the thing that really enables that is that you don't be critical of him. You don't criticize him or make him wrong for where he's at, because he's at where he's at. And he can change and transform and elevate his level of money maturity, but he's not going to do it if you're using, what is it, the carrot and the stick? You have to use the carrot, not the stick. So I hope that helps, Jody.
I was just wondering, Hillary, I kind of had a question on, because I don't think that Jody mentioned this in her question, but I mean, if you do talk with your spouse or your significant other and you're both on the same page with where you want your hopes and dreams financially to be, but then they are doing actions that are in direct opposition of those goals and dreams, then what?
Yeah, tricky, right? It's like, I just texted my husband, you scheduled the babysitter for Tuesday, but it's not on the calendar. So I don't know who the babysitter is. It's like, you have to plan your work and work your plan. And I think, again, the worst thing you can do in that situation is use the stick. In a relationship, it's always better to be kind and gentle and loving than it is to be nasty and critical. Has to be the last resort. And I think coming back to, hey, you know, we said we would do this, I noticed that you're doing that. I feel statements. I feel nervous about the future. I wonder, can I really trust you? We took all this time to create this plan, and now I feel like I'm giving relationship advice, but I mean, really,
marriage and money.
Yeah. I would just really try to stick to I feel statements, which is, you know, no one can argue with I feel. I feel nervous and vulnerable here. I'm in partnership with you. I want to trust you. And I'm wondering what's happening. And that's, you know, that's something that is probably not going to make someone defensive, hopefully.
Awesome.
Yeah. So in the vein of getting geared up for holiday spending and really taking on your money in a different way this holiday season, I've been thinking about you and I've been thinking about the gray matter, the brain that rules everything. And one of the things that we know about the human brain is that it's really only interested in having you survive. So it's a very binary kind of thing. If you've been through something before and you lived, the brain is very happy for you to just do that again. And what this leads to is this idea of being really stuck in a rut or comfortable in the muck. And so I want you to think about where you're stuck in your financial life. Where are you incurring costs, or where are you doing things you know you shouldn't want to be doing or don't want to do, but you just keep doing them because you can't sort of muster the activation energy to do something different. And I'm really committed that you thrive. And so today I'm actually replaying an interview that I did at the very beginning of Profit Boss Radio with my good friend Cheryl Hunter, who is an expert on not just surviving, but thriving. She is, you know, you'll hear me read her complete bio, but she and I had a lovely conversation about finally being done with those areas of life where you're comfortable in the muck and creating a life that totally lights you up and inspires you. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Cheryl Hunter on Profit Boss Radio. Hi, Profit Bosses. Our guest today is a truly remarkable woman, and I am proud to call her a friend. Just wait until you hear her story. It is absolutely moving, and it tells itself. Cheryl Hunter is a best-selling author, and she's founder of The Hunter Group, a coaching and consulting firm that helps people and organizations be their most productive, powerful, and resilient. Cheryl's called upon by news sources like CNN and Headline News, where she provides expert commentary on resilience for their audience. And here's why. While Cheryl was traveling abroad as a teenager, two men promised to make her a model. Instead, they abducted her, held her captive, and left her for dead. Once Cheryl was free, she became a model anyway. By the time she was 23, she had lived in 7 countries, and she'd been featured in every major magazine, and she was the worldwide Coca-Cola girl. As a response to captivity, Cheryl learned how to rise. In the process, she created an educational framework that anyone can use to overcome adversity and do the same. Her framework, which is at the core of the work that the Hunter Group offers, has been profiled by Forbes magazine, The Huffington Post, and is highlighted in all 5 of her TED Talks. Cheryl has helped over 250,000 people turn their lives around, break free from whatever holds them captive, and create lasting change. You are going to love this episode of Profit Boss Radio because this conversation Cheryl and I had really takes this work that I do, the finance of the interior, a step deeper than we usually go here. You're gonna wanna listen closely because there are some gems. Cheryl talked with me about how being abducted impacted her self-worth and how that led her to create a reality where she was working as a model in Europe, where even though the money was good, because she didn't think she was good, money didn't stay. Cheryl talks about what it's like to make a living as a model in New York City and how she's turned her own life's tragedy into her life's work. She'll share with you a powerful reframing technique to use if you earn more than your man and you think that's a problem, how to create practices that hardwire yourself for happiness, and how to actually change your brain. Enjoy. Cheryl, thanks so much for being on the show and welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Hillary.
Would you start by telling us just a little of your own money story? How did money go for you in the beginning?
Well, there was a time when my first job was modeling, and I had this big story in the background. I didn't tell anyone after I'd been abducted. I was a teenager. I'd never dealt with anything really difficult in my life at that point. And the only way I could come up with to deal with it, to cope, like literally to survive, was to hide it, even for myself, like to pretend this didn't happen. That, I thought, was the best strategy. So I had this big dark secret in the background that colored my worldview, the way I felt about myself, about other people, about certainly about my own worth. I thought that I was damaged somehow, you know, dirty, unclean, rotten, used up, you know, all you can imagine that a teenager might think. And I think that what's interesting about money is more than any other object that comes into our day-to-day lives, I find that there's a real correlation between money and worth. I think we've got those really collapsed in some way that they almost become synonymous for people. I know that they certainly were for me. So I had this sense myself where I was worthless in some regard. And then I would get these contracts where I would be paid, you know, a lot of money. And I'd feel like, oh, I remember getting one. I was in Spain. I was traveling all around Europe and Japan and, you know, going wherever the work was. I had gone to Spain for some trip. There was some Spanish Vogue or something. I don't even remember. But I thought, oh, this is so good. I need the photos. You know, I'd get good photos one place and it would leapfrog me to a better city. And I was hoping eventually to get enough great photos out of magazines to get to New York or Paris. And ultimately New York, that was the end game. Here I was in Spain and I'd gotten this big job and I thought, somebody from my agency, another girl, was like, wow, I heard you got that thing. And I said some sarcastic response like, yeah, it's a shocker, I know. It's a total miracle that I can't got that. I can't even believe it myself. I said something like this, they'll probably fire me, or something self-deprecating like that, just because at that age, I told you I had all that stuff going on in my head. And sure enough, they let me go. They had flown me there. They had trouble. And it's like I had some concern about being paid that amount of money, about getting that big of a job, about having all eyes on me, about getting the praise. I thought people were going to be, you know, upset or jealous. And it was all tied to worth and money. And so while I could have made really good money, and, you know, I did in spurts, it wasn't really as reliable as it could have been because I had something collapsed there. I had my worth that I thought was, you know, in the toilet collapsed with money.
Kind of like an upper limit problem.
Yeah, certainly. You know, a get it out of the toilet problem is really more like.
Right. Okay. So, and it makes sense that you would create this sort of function box. And I often talk about what I call our money operating systems as being a function box. No matter what you put in, you're going to get the same output. And so, and that's a function of those core beliefs and in what you're calling self-worth. And so you're putting sporadically big amounts of money in, and I'm guessing probably maybe behaving destructively with it or overspending or not saving or something like that. This sort of goes with the kind of picture you're painting.
It really does, doesn't it? It's like, you know, money habits, bad money habits 101,
yeah.
Almost.
Okay.
It's like a case study. You could kind of imagine that that's what would happen. And it in fact was. I would find myself either flush or with nothing at all.
Right.
Feast or famine kind of mentality. You hear that kind of thing, like with lottery winners who lose it all within a short period of time. And I was very much in that state because my sense of self-worth was compromised. And again, that worth was married in my head to the amount of money that I was able to earn.
Okay. And I definitely want to get into how you've transitioned that. I'm assuming you've transitioned that. But first, you know, I don't want to assume. First, when you're a model, how do you get paid more and more? So I imagine the jobs come through the agency. And do you just sort of take what the client is paying? Do the agents negotiate for you? Or how does that work? Do you have any conversation about the pay as the model?
You know, there's supermodels and then there's the rank and file models who do, you know, just day-to-day, whatever it is, magazines, catalogs, fashion shows. And that was the kind I did. You know, I think I was the lid on my own ability to be successful. I mean, I did a lot of big things. I was in, you know, the biggest magazines all over the world, although I never became a supermodel by any stretch. But how it works is when you are at one of those named models, you set your own price tag. You know, there was a thing back in the day, I remember hearing some of the supermodels from whenever had said, we don't get out of bed for less than $10,000 a day.
I think for Giselle, it's more like $100,000.
Yeah, right. I was like, okay, yeah, no, I get out of bed for less than that. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was like, you know, the 80s or something. Who knows what that was? But, you know, by the time I was modeling, I thought I would take whatever they gave me. And the thing that kind of fit along with my belief system at the time is there's this counterintuitive way that you are paid. Like if you do a big glamorous job, like for Vogue or Elle or Marie Claire or Glamour or something, and do the editorial shots in the magazine, the good shots, the ones that everybody wants, they pay you nothing, $100 a day, you know, something real, just pittance.
Oh my.
But if you do a catalog, you know, as something, you know, like a big box store in a mall, Macy's, for example, JCPenney's, Sears, something like this, you get paid quite well for those. You'll get a couple, few thousand a day, whatever it is, whatever your rate is, and depending on what they're advertising. But, you know, nobody wants to be seen in that stuff. But it kind of went along with it. Like, I'd be doing these glamorous things and be getting just nothing for it. Now, ultimately, it's to help you secure something big in the future, like some, you know, big advertising campaigns. But again, I really think that for me, that compromised sense of self-worth was the lid on what was possible there.
Right. And so at some point, how did you decide to get out of modeling?
Well, I really saw it as a means to an end. You know, for me, I'd originally wanted to do it because I grew up in this tiny little fabulous mountain town that while I loved it when I was a little kid, I started to look at it like a prison. I mean, I couldn't see, there were no buildings visible.
I read that about you. There was something like 122 other people besides you in the whole town. Maybe 125 horses.
There were, yeah, and half of those were farm animals. It was just so small. I had to get out. And I remember reading some magazine that they were looking for models. And I thought, oh, well, heck, nobody in Rye, Colorado models. Oh, that's the perfect ticket. I'm already on the boys' basketball team. I know I'm tall enough. What the
no,
heck?
No, you weren't really.
I mean, there you go. It's a small town. You know, they didn't have enough guys to start. And I started. But yes, I.
I bet you learned how to throw your elbows.
Yeah, I wasn't a center or anything, but, you know, tall enough to play and start. So I thought, I'm going to do this to get out. But I stayed in it long enough to, in fact, move to New York, get a home, build somewhat of a life, and then create what was next. But by that point, I realized I was going to have to face my demons. I was going to have to face that, all that was hiding under the surface from the abduction. And really, at that point, I started phasing out the modeling and looking at what was next. And I read every book anybody would recommend. I would read it. You know, I would kind of hint around like, oh, I'm kind of feeling, you know, a little depressed. And I'd read anything. I'd go to any program or do coaching or take any seminar or course or anything. Huh. I mean, anything I could do. I was volunteering a lot because I felt better when I did that.
And you were really looking for a way to improve,
Yes.
To survive, thrive.
And I took some personal development programs and thought, oh God, I feel so good when I'm here. It's just if I didn't have to wait the rest of the week until I came back. So I started training to lead them. And ultimately, you know, therein I found redemption. I trained to lead those and started leading professional development programs. And I handled my stuff in the midst of doing all that.
And what are you doing for a living while you're doing that? Are they paying you?
No, at the time I was segued from modeling into acting and started doing a lot of commercials mostly because it was good pay.
Oh, okay.
You know, I was a model who could speak in complete sentences. So they were like, hey, you're hired. Awesome. So I did a lot of those, but I also wrote for the years when I was really hiding the abduction. I journaled a lot. I wrote a lot and I developed an ability to get all my feelings out on paper. So I started writing and I wrote TV and film at the time. And I was doing that while I would go in and lead personal development seminars. And it wasn't long before the people who lead those also interact with people who lead professional development seminars. And I started doing both of those. And I noticed how I felt there and how others around me were benefited versus just, you know, writing comedy for some TV network. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go for the one that gives life more. So I started just leading programs and coaching development seminars and programs, doing that full time.
Wow.
And then developed my own education. And
it's really clear kind of the story that you're painting of the transition from modeling and acting to coaching and this idea that you solved your own problem or empowered yourself, broke through your own barriers, and now you teach them is sort of pretty similar to my own financially. The story that I tell, having reached financial rock bottom, turned it around for myself and now wanting to give it away. But my question is, how long does it take for you to go from being the victim of abduction and sexual violence to being the leader of personal development seminars? How long does that transition take?
Well, I mean, for me, it took a very long time. You know, I mean, it was well over a decade till I even told anybody.
Wow.
So that right there is a hurdle or an impediment that nobody else would have to face necessarily. I think being able to, it was a function of my age and that I was mortified and embarrassed and humiliated, as well as being physically, mentally, and emotionally hurt.
Yeah.
So that hurdle, nobody needs to go beyond. You know, we can shortcut that by just starting to tell the truth about what's so right now. But it took me, like I said, well over a decade. It took me way too long is the bottom line.
So did you start taking on paid coaching clients as a result of coaching personal transformation seminars?
I did. Like I said, there were a lot of people in the personal development space who, you know, what their day job is they go into companies and lead the same kinds of programs. And I could see that it seemed to be a real fit for me. I loved being able to contribute, and I was benefiting immensely. I had left behind all of the junk. I'd left that behind. And now, mind you, Hillary, there were still years to go from when I was doing that. I was leading those programs personally and professionally and coaching individuals and doing that for money until I decided to finally share my own story.
Right.
It was the impetus for what I did, but I just didn't talk about it.
Right. So everything follows the Pareto principle, right? And as a coach, you start with nothing. So what's that like? What's your financial life like as you start coaching and you're feeling that you've transitioned out of victimhood? You're having a visceral, I can tell, experience of life that's different. How is that impacting your financial life?
Well, it's funny. Originally, when I started leading personal development seminars, I did so as a volunteer, which,
right,
you know, really fits my fits the whole thing. I still felt a little messed up in the head. I was letting it go. I was going through all the work. While I had gotten complete about the abduction, I hadn't rooted up, like really pulled up from the roots, those disempowering beliefs about my own worth and worthiness. So I did this for years. I led personal development seminars for years. It wasn't until I started going into companies that I started actually being paid. And I thought, wow, I could be paid for this? That's amazing. I mean, now I was donating hours. I mean, hours of time.
Uh-huh.
Just by the hundreds, thousands even, ultimately, as an aggregate total. But it wasn't until I thought, wait, I could give up what I'm doing and do this. This is the thing that's making the biggest difference for me and those around me, that I could get paid. And I then first started with, again, like, oh, well, there's this leap between getting nothing and being worth nothing to getting paid something, to being paid this small amount. And I thought, let me first, I want to sort something out for myself. So I developed an educational framework. I looked at what it was that I had gone through and what I'd seen others had gone through that had, you know, created something new for themselves. And then I started beta testing my model, you know, this educational model with people. And once I got it sorted out and could see that it was causing not only results for them, but the people around them, that it was really, I wanted to get that sorted out first before I felt comfortable charging. Like there was something I had to handle first, like a question in my mind, distinct from my own sense of worth. But once I saw that it was delivering the results I hoped it had, and I got it into a couple of universities, and I went out and taught it there and saw that, okay, this is working. Then I felt comfortable. I had done everything I needed to do to start to really charge something that's commensurate with the difference it makes.
So your confidence was evidence-based.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah, I think that's a badge of someone with high integrity. And there are teachers who teach, you know, fake it till you make it. And I've never resolved that story or dichotomy for myself. I'm a very evidence-based person.
Yes.
You know, and so, but yet, you know, as we know, there are people out there flying high and doing great who aren't so much. So anyway, that's interesting. Okay, so you're coaching and you're making money, small amounts at first and then more, but you've developed this framework that's been taught in universities. And so maybe starting with the foundation of that framework is what allowed you to scale what you do, because I know you have coaches that coach your framework now, right?
I do.
And how does that look?
We're a team of 14.
Wow.
You know, they say, I heard the phrase, hire smarter than yourself.
Yes.
I was like, okay, let me bring in the people who trained me. I just got together a team of just brilliant people who already were phenomenal coaches.
Oh, that's awesome.
And just great at what they do and have an amazing way of reaching people and teaching, and they know how to, you know, different people with different areas of specialization, those who develop curricula, those who, you know, have specialize in organizational design and development, and those who specialize in schools or corporations or individuals. And I, you know, assembled a team, and then, you know, obviously the education had to be a fit for them and vice versa. But yeah, I you know, back to what you'd earlier said, I love the idea of fly by the seat of your pants and just go out there and, you know, fake it till you make it. I just,
it's a bit of a unicorn for me.
Yeah, right. I mean, I love the idea in theory, getting past the, you know, I don't want to get stuck in the proverbial analysis paralysis. Like, there's a thin line between leaping in and knowing nothing and then cogitating forever and never getting off the ground, getting ready to get ready to get ready forever. But there's somewhere in between, I found the sweet spot light. It's like, I want to develop as much as I can and then jump in. But I don't know that I answered your question.
That's okay. And you used the word cogitating, which is really, everyone got to have a good vocabulary word today. So thank you.
My mom you know, was telling us as kids, use the exact word, the precise word. You mean I can't just say good for everything?
Again, a model that speaks. It's wonderful. So can you talk a little bit about a prototypical client or the avatar of the client that you work with? And then specifically, I'm sure that your coaching touches on their financial life. And tell us how you apply your framework to the money conversation.
So, okay, a couple of different questions. One, that who do I work with? Generally, who I work with are people who are 40 to, say, 55, 60. Generally 40 to 55. But it's people who have had some degree of success already, you know, basic, you know, proven to themselves that they can accomplish what they set out to accomplish. And yet there's something there that's still calling, something there that's still unattained. You know, some of the big items haven't been crossed off the list, the things that matter most.
Okay.
And, you know, I found getting to that age myself, I started going, I started to be what I call legacy minded. Like, what's the point? What's it all for?
Yes.
And what difference is not just this day going to make or this week going to make, but this life going to make? And the people that come to me are asking that kind of question. What difference is it all going to make? What difference can they make in their companies, in their organizations, with their lives, with fulfilling their missions? That's the kind of thing that we get our hands on and kind of reverse engineer to find why it hasn't happened yet and how we can do it. Now, that may sound like an oversimplified view, but it really isn't. It's a systematic method we walk through to accomplish that.
So I find you can't tell what a person's financial life looks like from the way it seems like it would be on the outside. For example, I live on a street in Silicon Valley where most of the houses are worth between $1.5 and $2.5 million. But I know from my experience, you have no idea that the people who live inside those houses are actually rich. or mm-hmm. financially free or stress-free or even happy about their money, right?
Yeah.
And so I imagine you find a little bit of that. And I think publicly there are these archetypes of people, the under-earner, the overspender. It sounds like you maybe work with some of the archetypal business owners, like the power female, the executive with the high income. There's like the trust fund kid and the rich housewife. But I find that nobody really fits into those archetypes neatly. And we make assumptions about people, and that leaves a lot of people feeling really misunderstood and like they're all alone and like they can't talk about their financial life with people. So people like you and me who get to dig in with people and see what's really going on underneath, you know, I really like to talk about real stories, and so that stories that people would be surprised are true. So I'm wondering, first, can you confirm what I'm saying? Is that true in your coaching world? And would you share kind of some of the unique or painful or even triumphant stories that you've seen that are really going on in people's lives?
Yes. So there's, you're spot on about the archetypes, about not fitting neatly into those boxes. I hadn't looked at that from that perspective before. That's just brilliant, Hillary.
Well, we just paint swaths onto people, right? She pulls up in a Jag and you know 15 things about her that I know, 14 of which probably aren't true.
Yeah. So a lot of the majority, I'd say, of the people I work with are executives who are frazzled. That doesn't paint the whole picture. You know, like they're, and I say that just because there's so much on their plate. But it's like trying to have it all, and we're societally trying to figure out what that is. You know, do we lean in? Do we lean out? Do we quit? Do we jump? Do we ship?
Which direction do we lean?
Right. So there was people that I have coaching engagements with who specifically sign a release for me to use them as case studies.
Okay.
So I'm not betraying anything.
Sure. And you can anonymize it, and it's just as powerful.
So there's a woman I work with who came to me. She was doing very well and helped companies in the healthcare field start up. She helped put these companies together and start them up, get them running and like that, put them together with finances, all that, just get them launched. And she earned more money than any man she would ever date. And while that, you know, you might look at that like, awesome. It didn't turn out that way for her. She had a conversation about it. Like, that was like being a foot taller than any man.
Sure. Emasculates him.
Yeah. Somehow being more masculine than him and left him less so exactly emasculated. So we really got her to a place where, well, let me back up one step. There was something that was happening was in the past couple of these engagements that she'd gone in to, something was going wrong. And she even was like getting to the point where she was like, am I going to be let go from this one? I don't know what's happening. Have I lost my touch? The Midas touch is gone. I don't know what's happening. My magic, I think, has fizzled. My mojo has died. And really what we got to the source of is it's that she was earning so much more money than somebody she had been engaged to, and she thought that was the root of the problem of why their engagement broke off. So she's like, yeah, I can't continue to earn money like this. You know, we make all these decisions underneath the level of our conscious awareness and then wonder why our life goes the way it does. And it's like, no, that's the opposite thing I wanted to happen.
Right.
And we ask ourselves questions like, am I self-sabotaging? I don't get it. And it really just bringing awareness to a lot of these things has them start to resolve themselves on their own. And then with some good work, you can get those things complete. But it enabled her to get back on her game and then have a powerful frame in which to hold how much she earns. So she found ways to start investing and start contributing that she hadn't done before. Like, she created a context for herself, like, what is this money for? What's it ultimately for? What difference does she want to make with it? Now, I don't coach people on finances,
right,
per se. I work with them on their relationship to it all. You know, themselves, their work, their lives. But that's, your relationship to money is a very fundamental part of our relationship to life. So that's one example of somebody whose relationship to money was a less than powerful one, and it had started to really go south.
Yes. And I think that's really interesting. That's a lot of the women who come into my purview is they have some money. Many people would consider it to be enough money. They want more, but society tells them they're rich. And so it's this juxtaposition of wanting more and not being willing or able to say that publicly, and at the same time having to hide what they have. Mm. So I think that's really interesting. And is there kind of an opposite story of that? Someone who from the outside maybe looked wildly successful and was barely holding it together, or, you know, feel free to tell whatever story you were going to tell. Let me not interrupt.
I'm thinking for a moment. Here's a story that's kind of at the forefront of my mind. She and I, we actually spoke earlier today, and she's from a different country, Southeast Asia, where it's culturally not acceptable to have a ton of money. It's not.
Not for women or not for people?
Both, as she tells it.
Okay.
And when she goes to visit her mother, her mother will say things like, you know, what are these shoes? How dare you wear these shoes? You know, or these clothes? They're so, you're not focused on the things that matter most. This is a slap in the face to the Buddha to wear these kind of clothes and when there are people starving and things like this. Mm-hmm. And she found such an internal conflict. How dare I? How dare I be bringing in this kind of salary? How dare I do this? And was wanting to, you know, just came at this point like that she felt, it, you know, and really internally conflicted. And it's funny, these are both examples of people who they're quite dramatic examples. But I assert that each one of us has something conflicting underneath the surface. We say we want one thing, yet we do another. Or we, you know, want money, but we feel some other way about it.
Yes.
And it's that process of unpacking it. In the process of looking at it, she wasn't even aware of all those things. She just knew that she didn't have a very good relationship with her mother.
Oh.
You know, in the process of unpacking and identifying and looking at, I'm not talking about just navel gazing and sitting around being fascinated by your own thoughts. That's not at all the point. Who cares about that junk? But really looking at and examining how we think, how we feel, how we act. What are the core beliefs behind all that? And then what? Then what can we do that matters? For us, for our immediate circles, for our communities, for the people around us, and whatever, you know, those concentric circles outward, in whatever varying degree a person wants to contribute. She too, on her own accord, I didn't suggest any of this, found a way really to contribute and start to do that on a financial basis in a way that has her really feel fulfilled. And interestingly enough, has her mother feel proud.
Oh, that is interesting. And so you've mentioned financial contribution to the community in both of these examples. Do you think that is an inherent human need once our cup is full, so to speak, once Maslow's first levels of the pyramid are fulfilled? Or is that what they now call a first world problem? Is that a trend?
Yeah, that's a good question, Hillary. I don't know that it's always financial, because some people want to get their hands in the dirt, so to speak, go out there and dig or build houses like Habitat for Humanity, or, you know, go overseas and help with, you know, Doctors Without Borders or something like that. But the need to contribute, I think, runs to our core. And wrote a book called Use It, Turn Setbacks into Success. But I think ultimately each one of us wants to use what we've been handed to make some difference. And oftentimes how we look at what we've been handed is, wait, I don't want this. I want that over there, the smooth and easy life.
Right.
But I think the need to contribute runs as deep as the need to sleep and eat. I think we want to have our lives make a difference, whether people know it was from us or not. We want to matter somewhat, help ease the burden of others. It's really one of the things I teach people is, in the midst of it, go help somebody else. Super simple as heck, right? But
Yeah. It's
one of the few things that quiets that nattering conversation in our own head, as Gestalt therapy calls it, the internal dialogue, that yakety yak that won't cease. Help others and it'll stop. You know, contribute. And it does something. So whether it's financial or otherwise, I think that is not a first world problem. I think that is something that people long to do the world over. I just profiled this fabulous woman who's from Africa and has created this product to help. She has a foundation called the Upendo Foundation to help girls and women with the immense problem of what to do when their monthly cycle hits. I mean, I was like, what? That's a problem?
That's kind of my response. What?
Yeah. The young girls in her country and in Nigeria and in other countries can't use tampons because it's seen to take their virginity. So they've got pads as an option, but they can't afford them. And worse yet, if they can, they've got no place to dispose of them. So she's created something where they can, these washable things that double as panties. I mean, so that's not a first world issue. That's not, you know, people want to contribute. If it's financially great, whatever it is.
Wow, that's amazing. And I'll, by the way, include links to your book, Use It, and this Upendo.
Yes.
Wherever we can find, I'll include a link in the show notes so folks can find it if you go to hillaryhendershot.com/show notes. So thanks for mentioning that. And I think all of this really, I mean, first of all, it was a huge deal for me when I felt like, when what was in reality true for me, I still didn't have enough money, although I was positive cash flow. So I had stopped paying, you know, spending indebtedly and was paying off the debt, is I carved out a portion of my budget for giving it away. I had a certain amount of money, and that amount has grown over time, that I can choose in the moment to give away to someone who knocks on my door or asks me at the store, or my many, many friends who run marathons and triathlons now. You know, I can give. And in fact, you know, if I don't, I'm over budget or underspending for the month. And it's been extremely fun and rewarding for me. So just a small example of proving to yourself that there is enough. For those of you who are in a mindset that there isn't enough, in order for there to be enough, you have to sort of make that declaration. And if you're giving it away, then you have to have enough. And I think that that's probably true energetically as well. And so all this really, I think, lands nicely into this conversation, something that you talk a lot about, Cheryl, which is that the brain really is wired just to survive, that we don't really realize how much our brain is completely happy if we live through any situation, no matter how sad or upset or unfulfilled it makes us. And so I wonder, you know, what you would say about that as it regards money. And then how come there are people who seem to be thriving despite this? Or is it just a matter of where you land somewhere in the spectrum between surviving and thriving?
Well, if you look at it as a species, just consider this for a moment, like rather than looking at a reason why not, like, well, but, you know, it's not that way for everybody or not all the time, or just consider for a moment that as a species, the one thing that is there hardwired in is the imperative, the biological imperative to survive. Yes. And, you know, it makes us eat. It makes us sleep. It's why we breathe. You know, a little kid will get frustrated and go, I'm going to hold my breath until you blank, you know, until you let me do so and so. And the kid will hold their breath and their body will make them breathe. Even if they hold their breath till they pass out.
Right, the body shuts you off so you will breathe.
Shut you down. Yes. Body smart. There's a biological imperative to survive.
You no longer get to decide.
Right. Okay, override. You're making dumb decisions. We need to step in. But there's no hardwiring for happiness. There's no hardwiring for joy and thriving. It's not that we don't experience them. We do. But it's not hardwired into the system.
Like, it doesn't get into the neural patterns.
Yes. If you look in the veins or, you know, in the circulatory system or the lungs, there's nothing hardwired in there like be happy. It's like, you know, bring oxygen.
Right.
That's it. That kind of thing.
Get bring water.
There's that. Hardwired for that. So sometimes people happen upon it. We get happy when, and it's like you'd said earlier about circumstantial evidence. It's circumstantial. We have a good hair day. Hey, man, things are great. Somebody cuts us off in traffic. I'm mad, or my boss gives me way too much work or doesn't acknowledge me for the work I have done. We don't have such a good day. A relationship ends. We're sad. We're, you know, we're the victim of our circumstances a lot of the times, because our emotional state isn't hardwired in to be happy. So then if that's the case, one possible way to look at it is that it's a created act. Happiness, fulfillment, the ability to thrive has to be created. And so that's a lot of the work that we take on together when we go look at, well, okay, where did the difficulty start and when did that happen? But more importantly, how do we then hardwire you as close as we can do to being happy and to thriving if it's not the automatic built-in state? And there's a lot of things we can do, such as putting practices in, daily practices that provide a sense of thriving or happiness or fulfillment. And it's in the same way, like you'd said, it's so brilliant, Hillary, that you'd said that you create a budget with contribution built right in.
Well, you can call me brilliant anytime. Thank you. And it works for me.
You've got this practice where every month or every day or whatever, however that is often for you, you've got to give away
money.
You got to give away a certain amount of money. And if you know, you could break it down to be a monthly thing. I got to give away $100 this month, $1,000 this month, $10 this month, you know, whatever's there. But if you broke it down to daily, okay, I got to find somebody I'm going to give $20 to today. Who's it going to be? It could be a game. I mean, if you look at that and you've created this practice, you've put it there for yourself. What does that do to your state of mind? Somebody cuts you off in traffic. Oh, move out of the way, whoever it is. I don't care about that. Let me get that out of my sight because what I want to look at, out of my line of sight, because what I want to look at, I want to look for, who's this person that's going to get the $25? $20, whatever it is. I got to find that. And it starts to shape the way we feel and think and act and hear things and see things and respond. We can do the as close as we can to hardwiring in by creating practices like that that call us forth.
Oh, so that's really interesting. And I really like the way you position that as a viewpoint. Like, how can I create a framework or a filter, like putting rose-colored glasses on, through which the rose-colored glasses have me see the world as rose-colored, but what kind of glasses can I put on or a filter can I put on that has me see opportunities that actually leave me feeling fulfilled and happy? And one of the things I talk a lot about is the impact of this programming, and I'm fascinated by the idea of rewiring our minds. I don't know if I'm going to get this out right, but a lot of people, women specifically, let's take a woman in business, for example, who needs to, let's say she runs a marketing consulting business and she needs to sell a package, and she can price that package anywhere she wants to price it. I mean, no one is to say what the true value is except between she and the buyer, right? And there are people who chronically undercharge, and they experience that they undercharge because their perception of charging more is bad, or they couldn't, or it's not worth it, or, but they relate to it like they undercharge because of some reality that's out there.
Yes.
And I invite people to consider that they actually undercharge to manifest the reality that's already hardwired in their brain. This idea of surviving and not thriving, that the survival wiring has that reality be true for you, that subjective reality, right? And you live like it's true, but it's not. And then every once in a while, you'll have an experience that undermines that reality you thought was true. So I may have gotten a little lost in putting this out there, but I'm wondering what you think about how do people rewire that? If they know that that's their reality or some version of it is their reality, and, you know, apply that to a woman negotiating for a salary or, I don't know, asking for spousal support or something like that. But how can you subvert that cycle?
Well,
did I put you on the spot?
No. It's perfect. One of the things that is the biggest breakthroughs for us in modern times is that neuroscience has proved that neuroplasticity is a real thing. We can change not only our thoughts and feelings and attitudes and habits, but our brains. neuroplasticity has proven that. The delving science into that has proven that we can change that. So how do you change it?
Neuroplasticity is the sort of change, the rewiring of the brain.
Change how the brain is wired. Change those neural pathways, the tracks down which thought goes. And if we have this neural pathway already grooved called, ugh, I don't ever have enough money. You know, there's some conversation there, like I said, in quote, internal dialogue, as Gestalt therapy coined the phrase 50 years ago or whatever, where the internal dialogue, the conversation there will be like, oh, I don't have enough money, or there's never enough to go around, or whatever that conversation is. The first...
And then your reality manifests.
Yeah,
it.
Precisely. We start then just having that. The first thing to do is simply look at the results you have right now. Results don't lie. So there's looking at the results and then being willing to tell the truth about them. And this is a generous act, a courageous act, a bold act. Because, I mean, nobody wants to look at the junk that doesn't work in their own lives, let alone, you know, seizing ownership over it and going, let's see, I come in just squeak by every single month. And I've been doing that for about a decade and a half. Okay, so let's call that a pattern. What is underneath that? And the work that I do is we kind of take a walk down memory lane and see where it got created. Not because it's therapy or I want to hang out in the past or any of that nonsense, but because there's something that got put in there and a neural pathway in a real way got grooved around it. So if it's like there's barely enough to go around, if that's the conversation, have you ever noticed that when you have a thought that you have persistently, it's kind of hard to think something different? Have you ever noticed that?
I can say it. I believe that intellectually, but my heart does not.
Yeah, but there's something, it's the reason why it's hard to change a thought that is persistent is because it literally gets grooved into the brain, like a street that's, you know, not like a dirt road, rather. Let me put it that way. I'm from Colorado. I've seen plenty of dirt roads. We've all seen a dirt road or at least a picture of one, right? A path of some kind that there's enough traffic on it. It starts to get grooved down in. It's the way, one way to go. And a neural pathway, I'm no neuroscientist, but I sure love it. Listen to podcasts and study it whenever I can. But there's, you know, our thoughts, our lines of thought and thinking are the same way. So if we keep going down it with this limiting belief about money, it's going to keep manifesting the same thing. We're powerful beings. So the first thing is to notice what's actually there in reality, tell the truth about it, and then start to see what could be created instead. Create something else and then create practices that will help hardwire the new thinking in. Just having a new thought won't create new neural pathways that will default to what's already there, what's already well worn. If you want to create new neural pathways and truly change the thinking and then ultimately change the results, you gotta work on creating something new and getting it in there with practices so it happens over and over and over and over and over again and starts to become habitualized, just like the old way of thinking was. Now, one last caveat to it, the negative kind of thinking is, here's the catch, it's survival-based. Saying something to ourselves like, oh, there's never enough money. It puts us in kind of a survival mode. So it becomes...
Counterintuitively.
Right? As screwy as it is, it becomes tied to that actual hardwiring that we have that's for survival. So we got to create a counter-programming. And that's where the work comes in. But we got to do it anyway or else suffer the consequences. We may as well go into it with a sense of liveliness and fun, like in the example of creating the practice of, who am I going to give $20 to today? I'm going to find the best, most exciting possible opportunity ever. Practices.
Can you give a quick example of someone who has done that rewiring, who created a new dirt path, neural pathway around a thought that they wanted to create?
Absolutely. I had a client who was trained as a dancer, just phenomenal, has danced all over the world, classical dance, does all kinds of dance, and wanted to open up a dance studio for, you know, eventually. She's like, I can't dance ever. You know, I'm not going to be a 45-year-old prima ballerina. You know, it's like, it doesn't last.
I've heard that's not the way.
I got to do something else. I got to create something. And she wanted to teach the love of dance, but she had this conversation. Dancers are broke. She had the proverbial starving artist conversation. We've all heard it. And it's, you know, there's a heck of a lot of people out there who concur with it. They've seen that they agree.
It's one of those archetypes.
Precisely. But she wanted to create something different. It gave her an entire life, one that she passionately loves. And she's seen it do it to countless others. And she wants to give this joy away. And whether it's that other people end up with a career as a dancer, or they just find themselves at home in their bodies, you know, they feel happy about themselves. They find a creative outlet. They find a way to relieve stress, whatever it is. She wanted to give that gift of dance to people. So one of the things we realized is she had this conversation. It wasn't there on the surface, but we just dug a little bit and found dancers never make anything. I'll never make anything, she thought, as a studio owner. Well, we got rid of the old conversation by supplanting it with something new. She started thinking about, well, when do people make a lot of money as dancers? And she started coming up with how much people pay to go see the ballet and all this. And she created something for herself that was really exciting. She started engaging. She did this project where she started interviewing other dancers that she had worked with over the years and having them say their favorite things about dance, what they loved most about it, what they felt was most life-giving about it for themselves, for the audiences, etc. And she made this book of, you know, the life that dance gives. And whenever she would start to have that, oh, but there's no money in it, she would have to go read something from there. And that would become a practice that she did every single day, was to engage, you know, not only read it, but then engage in conversations with other dancers and people about dance. In other words, she kept the spirit of dance alive, and it became much more important than the conversation about, oh, but there's no money in it. It supplanted it ultimately, and that became the dominant conversation for her. Now, I didn't tell her how to do it. She came up with something that was a self-expression for her. Suffice it to say, January is 3 years. Oh, it's January now. Yes, January, mid-January is 3 years since she actually went into business with a partner. And that's the perfect example.
That is fantastic. And it's nonlinear, right? She didn't have to replace there's no money in it with there's lots of money in it.
Right. And then have to have this internal, you know, like cognitive dissonance between no, but I know there's none. There, but there is. No, there isn't. No, there is. No, there isn't. None of that nonsense. She came up with something that was a joy for her. She found the joy in it and had that carry the day. And it was the thing that made the new neural pathways.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to transition a little bit here. Cheryl, can I ask you, what do you think, do you know, or do you have an idea what you think your economic independence number is? Are you striving for a particular number? And have you thought about that or planned for that?
Well, yes and no. I've thought of it. You know, I live near the beach and I know what the houses right on the beach go for. So that's part of it. I kind of started by coming up with it that way. I was like, okay, here's an arbitrary number, rather than having that, I'm going to reverse engineer it by here's what this kind of house does. Here's how much giving I want to do. Here's what contribution I want to make. Here's how much, you know, I've just worked it out that way.
So you added it all up and reverse engineered it.
Right. But this may be a superstition, but I've thought, oh, I don't want to put a cap on it, like a lid on it, by becoming too married to that number.
Yes.
This amount by that time. So I've, you know, for that reason, I look toward it. I strive toward it. I keep it in my plans, like when I'm doing whatever kind of creation and journaling work that I do, or, you know, vision board type things. But I don't want to put a lid on it too much. So that's been my thinking.
So now, do you think reaching that number is a foregone conclusion? What's your relationship to where you are in relationship to that number? I mean, do you experience it being already achieved? For example, do you experience anxiety because you haven't, me not knowing where you are terms of that number?
It's something I realign myself with. I don't experience anxiety about it. There's a teacher by the name of Panache Desai. He's an author. He and I used to lead programs together, workshops that we designed, and he's Oprah's darling right now. He's phenomenal. But he gave me these words once upon a time, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, where he said, it's already everything each of us wants to accomplish. Take the case that it's already all accomplished. It's already all worked out. Your job is to now watch it unfold. And the gift of the present moment is you get to actually watch it happen in real time. And so I try to bring that to it whenever I go, but wait. There's only a finite number of houses in this area, and I see them all being bought up. And it's like, nope, come back here. I am oriented towards being evidence-based. I'm like, I'm providing value. I'm standing here. I'm doing my work. That will happen.
Okay, based on your experience, what advice... By the way, can I ask, what's the approximate price range of those houses you're talking about?
The houses are, it depends, $4 million, something like that.
Oh, wow. You're in Southern California?
I am.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the crazy thing. A couple houses went for like $2.5 million, and they tore them down to the studs.
Because they weren't good enough.
But yeah, because it was, they just wanted the lot. I was like, okay, got it. I got to up the game. Okay, yep. I'm going to add, I need to add some more numbers onto this number here.
Adding zeros. Thank you. So based on your experience in coaching, what advice would you give women to either start or stop doing so that having a secure financial future becomes their reality?
Start or stop. Stop believing the negative thoughts in your head.
Yeah.
And consider that the majority of what we say to ourselves is negative. It's one of the fundamental tenets I say in my book, Use It, Turn Setbacks into Success, is your thoughts are not on your side. They're really not your friends. You know,
no.
So stop believing those.
Isn't that amazing?
That's the thing to stop doing. And to start doing is create practices that ingrain truly in your thinking, in your brain, in your world, that which you're most committed to.
Now, it's almost like you're reading my mind here when you mentioned practices, because I also want to know, what are the practices you swear by that make you more productive, lucrative, or effective?
For me, one of the practices that I have to have is I need some kind of exercise daily, just for me personally. It feels like it gets my juices going. It's one of those. I create vision boards.
Ooh.
I love it. I just love looking at them. And I take a moment to look at them every day. I take silent time, meditative time. There's an author by the name of Dina Proctor, who I have met and got to work with and become friends with. And she advocates for these 3-minute power focus breaks throughout the day. It's a chance to, you know, meditate and focus. And I love doing that. Just taking short, focused bursts of focus. I don't know how else to call that.
Is it thinking?
It's
journaling?
It's like really meditating.
Okay.
But just do it for short periods of time to allow you to come back to center. That's one of the best things that I do. And then finally, for me personally, I have to make a list and work from a list. Otherwise, I'm too wobbly on what I'm doing. But I will add one more thing. Find out what works for you. Experiment with practices. What works best?
Now, are you one of these who advocates having only 3 things on your list? Or are you like me and there's always...
Lord.
Yeah. Okay.
It's so awesome, but I'll add.
I can never get it to 3. Okay. Now I'm going to mention your book in the show notes. Again, it's called Use It. But do you have a favorite book about money or something that you think would impact women's relationship to money that you'd recommend?
Oh my, I'm trying to think. What is that Lynn Twist book called? Suddenly I can't.
It's called The Soul of Money.
I think that's great. Okay.
Yeah, it's interesting because for much of that book, I thought that Lynn was actually in protest of the very system of money, right? It seems like she's kind of down on money, but Lynn is doing amazing things in the rainforest and for women. It's really incredible.
Right.
Okay, now Cheryl, you have a free gift that you've offered to the Profit Boss Radio audience, and thank you so much for that. And can you tell us a little bit about that gift?
What I normally do is give these books as gifts to people who bought my book. It's three videos that are real deep dive videos. I have free videos all over my website that are just short little 5-minute ones, but these are more in depth. And I think they'll just provide a lot more sort of deeper cut into the stuff we talked about today and more.
Okay, great. And yeah, and I'm on your weekly list and I get your short videos and they're great. And I think what's different about you that I'm always impressed by is you're able to dig into these, what I consider to be more conceptual topics. My brain is so like linear and action oriented. And I really appreciate the nuance that you're able to go into. And I want you to know that I have on my daily, I have a Trello board, which is my to-do list. And I have these ongoing personal strategies, like the things I'm working on now, like always creating an empowering context. But one thing I took from one of your videos is stop the comparisons, stop comparing myself to other people and find something I love about myself and obsess on it.
Oh, nice.
And I think those two were in a confidence video.
You're absolutely right. Yes.
Yes. And so I'm really taking those to heart. And I can't, for me, I can't just tell myself one time. I have to tell myself, I'm creating new dirt paths, Cheryl. I'm rewiring. So thank you for that. And you can get a link to that free gift at hilaryhendershot.com/show notes. Thank you so much, Cheryl. It's been an incredible conversation and I'm just really inspired. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Profit Boss Radio. If you liked it, share it with an artist or creative that you love. And whether you're a painter or a mathematician, may you have all the freedom and prosperity you want.